influence the direction of the temperature trend. Summary. Over the last 150 years, significant changes in climate have been recorded, including a 0.74 degrees Celsius increase in average global temperatures over the last 100 years, sea level rise of over 40 millimeters, significant shifts in the seasonality and intensities of precipitation, changing weather patterns, significant retreat of Arctic sea ice and nearly all continental glaciers. We know that in the last 150 years, the 12 warmest years on record have all occurred within the last 13 years, with 1998 the warmest year, followed by 2005, 2002, 2003, and 2004, while 2007 was the 8th warmest year on record. The IPCC 2007 report states that the evidence for global warming is unequivocal, and there is very high confidence that this warming is due to human activity. Chapter 4. How do you model the future? You may not believe this, but the whole of human society operates on knowing the future, particularly the weather. For example, a farmer in India knows when the monsoon rains will come next year, and so when to plant his crops, while a farmer in Indonesia knows there are 2 monsoon rains next year, so he can plant crops twice. This is based on their knowledge of the past, as the monsoons have always come at about the same time each year in living memory. But such a prediction goes deeper than this, as it influences every part of our lives. Our houses are built for the local climate. In Britain, that means central heating but no air conditioning, while in the southern USA, it is vice versa. Roads, railways, airports, offices, cars, trains, and so on are all designed for the local climate. This is why in the spring of 2003, a centimeter of snow one afternoon effectively shut down London, while Toronto can easily deal with and function with 0.5 meter of snow. In Europe in 2003, 35,000 people died in the summer heat wave in temperatures that regularly occur in the tropics, while Australians go into shock if the temperature drops below 50 degrees Fahrenheit. The problem with global warming is that it changes the rules. The past weather of an area cannot be relied upon to tell you what the future will hold. So we have to develop new ways of predicting the future, so that we can plan our lives and so that human society can continue to fully function. So, we have to model the future. There is a whole hierarchy of climate models, from relatively simple box models to the extremely complex three-dimensional general circulation models, GCMs. Each has a role in examining and furthering our understanding of the global climate system. However, it is the complex three-dimensional general circulation models which are used to predict future global climate. These comprehensive climate models are based on physical laws represented by mathematical equations that are solved using a three-dimensional grid over the globe. To obtain the most realistic simulations, all the major parts of the climate system must be represented in sub-models, including atmosphere, ocean, land surface, topography, cryosphere, and biosphere, as well as the processes that go on within them and between them. Most global climate models have at least some representation of each of these components. Models that couple together both the ocean and atmosphere components are called Atmosphere-Ocean General Circulation Models, AOGCMs. Models of different parts of the climate system are first developed separately and then coupled into the comprehensive climate models. For example, the Met Office Hadley Center model is the first AOGCM which now has a fully coupled dynamic vegetation model. This is important because it has long been known that vegetation has an influence on climate. Thus, climate changes can affect the vegetation, and those changes in vegetation can have an effect on climate. For example, the Amazon rainforest recycles about half the precipitation that falls, maintaining a moist continental interior which would otherwise be dry. One of the key aspects of climate models is the detail in which they can reconstruct the world. This is usually termed spatial resolution. In general, the current generation of AOGCMs have a resolution or detail of the atmosphere of 1 point every 250 kilometers by 250 kilometers in the horizontal and about 1 kilometer in the vertical, above the boundary layer. This would mean the atmosphere above the British Isles would be represented by only 10 points. The resolution of a typical ocean model is about 200 to 400 meters in the vertical and 125 to 250 kilometers in the horizontal. Equations are typically solved for every simulated half hour of a model run. Many physical processes, such as cloud and ocean convection, of course take place on a much smaller scale than the model can resolve. Therefore, the effects of small-scale processes have to be lumped together. And this is referred to as parametrization. Many of these parametrizations are, however, checked with separate small-scale process models to validate the scaling up of these smaller influences. The reason that the spatial scale is limited is that comprehensive AOGCMs are very complex and use a huge amount of computer time to run. At the moment, much of the improvement in computer processing power that has occurred over the last decade has been used to improve the representation of the global climate system by coupling more models directly to the AOGCMs. It is important to run these models numerous times because there are many parts of the climate system for which the future parameters are uncertain. For example, the future human greenhouse gas emissions, which are not fixed as they will depend on many variables, such as the global economy, development of technology, political agreements, and personal lifestyles. Hence, you could produce the most complete model in the world, taking 2 years to simulate the next 100 years, but you would have only one prediction of the future based on only one estimate of future emissions, which might be completely wrong. Individual models are therefore run many times with different inputs to provide a range of changes in the future. In fact, the IPCC have consulted the results of multiple runs of 23 different AOGCMs to provide the basis for their predictions. Of course, as computer processing power continues to increase, both this representation of coupled climate systems and the spatial scale will continue to improve. So, what are the unknowns, and why do we need to run many different model scenarios? Is there not just one view of the future? Unfortunately, not. And each of the unknowns will be described in more detail, along with how they affect our model predictions for the future. Carbon cycle. One of the fundamental considerations for the AOGCMs is not whether carbon dioxide influences global temperatures, but rather the extent to which it influences global temperatures. This is not only because of the direct effect of the carbon dioxide, but also because of the many secondary influences and other climate feedbacks, such as aerosols, ocean circulation, and so on, which may even cool the climate system. The first problem is estimating how much of the anthropogenic carbon dioxide makes it into the atmosphere. You will be surprised to know that about half of all our carbon emissions are absorbed by the natural carbon cycle and do not end up in the atmosphere, but rather in the oceans and the terrestrial biosphere. This leads us to realize that we need to understand the present-day carbon cycle in order to understand the amount of carbon dioxide that will end up in the atmosphere. The Earth's carbon cycle is extremely complicated, with both sources and sinks of carbon dioxide. Figure 13 in the accompanying PDF shows the global carbon reservoirs in GTC, gigatons, or 1,000 million tons, and fluxes, the ins and outs of carbon in GTC per year. These indicated figures are annual averages over the period 1980 through 1989. It must be remembered that the component cycles have been simplified, and the figures only present average values. The amount of carbon stored and transported by rivers, particularly the anthropogenic portion, is currently very poorly quantified and is not shown here. Evidence is accumulating that many of the fluxes can vary significantly from year to year. In contrast to the static view conveyed in figures like this one, the carbon system is dynamic and coupled to the climate system on seasonal, interannual, and decadal timescales. The most interesting figure is that the surface ocean takes up just less than half the carbon dioxide produced by industry per year. However, this is one of the most poorly known figures, and there is still considerable debate over whether the oceans will continue to be such a large sink or absorber of our pollution. As we will see in Chapter 6, one of the great surprises recently has been the unexpected experimental results which suggest that the Amazon rainforest could be absorbing large quantities of atmospheric carbon dioxide. The key question we need to ask, if indeed this is the case, is, for how long will the oceans and the Amazon rainforest continue to absorb carbon dioxide? Cooling effects. As well as the warming effects of the greenhouse gases, the Earth's climate system is complicated in that there are also cooling effects. This includes the amount of particles in the air, which are technically called aerosols, many of which come from human pollution, such as sulfur emissions from power stations, and these have a direct effect on the amount of solar radiation that hits the Earth's surface. Aerosols may have significant local or regional impact on temperature. In fact, the AOGCMs have now factored them into the computer simulations of global warming, and they provide an explanation of why industrial areas of the planet have not warmed as much as previously predicted. Water vapor is a greenhouse gas, but at the same time, the upper white surface of clouds reflects solar radiation back into space. This reflection is called albedo, and clouds and ice have a high albedo and so reflect large quantities of solar radiation from surfaces on Earth. Predicting what will happen to the amount and types of clouds and the extent of global ice in the future creates huge difficulties in calculating the exact effect of global warming. For example, if the polar ice cap melts, the albedo will be significantly reduced, as this ice would be replaced by vegetation or open water, both of which absorb heat rather than reflecting it, like white snow or ice. This would produce a positive feedback, enhancing the effects of global warming. Emission models of the future. A critical problem with trying to predict future climate is predicting the amount of carbon dioxide emissions that will be produced in the future. This will be influenced by population growth, economic growth, third world development, fossil fuel usage, the rate at which we switch to alternative energy, the rate of deforestation, and the effectiveness of international agreements to cut emissions. Out of all the systems that we are trying to model into the future, humanity is by far the most complicated and unpredictable. If you want to understand the problem of predicting what will happen in the next 100 years, imagine yourself in 1909 and what you would have predicted the world to be like in 2009. In 1909, the British Empire was the dominant world power due to the Industrial Revolution and the use of coal. Would you have predicted the switch to a global economy based on oil after the Second World War, or the explosion of car use, or the general availability of air travel? Even 15 years ago, it would have been difficult to predict the budget airlines which allow for such cheap flights throughout Europe and the USA. So what the IPCC has done is to produce six scenarios of what the future could be like depending on these factors. These are based on the IPCC Special Report on Emission Scenarios, SRES, of 2000. The SRES, in terms of carbon dioxide equivalent in the atmosphere in 2100, are B1, 600 ppm, A1T, 700 ppm, B2, 800 ppm, A1B, 850 ppm, A2, 1250 ppm, and A1FL, 1500 ppm. Remember, we are currently at about 380 ppm. The IPCC also has a seventh scenario for illustrative purposes, which is at the constant year 2000 concentrations, as this shows the climate change we have already instigated. However, these emissions scenarios have been heavily criticized. The biggest criticism is that the emissions scenarios are too generous, because, as many experts point out, we are already putting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere per year than the most dire IPCC predictions. In the 1990s, carbon dioxide emissions increased by 1.1% per year. Between 2000 and 2004, they had increased to more than 3%. Future global temperatures and sea level. 23 AOGCMs have been run using selected future carbon dioxide emission scenarios for the IPCC 2007 report to produce global average temperature changes that may occur by 2100. This is a significant change from the IPCC 2001 report, in which only 7 of these models were used. These climate models, using the full likely range, show that the global mean surface temperature could rise by between 1.1 degrees Celsius and 6.4 degrees Celsius by 2100. Using the best estimates for the six emission scenarios, then, this range is 1.8 degrees Celsius to 4 degrees Celsius by 2100. Model experiments show that even if all radiation-forcing agents were held at a year 2000 constant, there would still be an increase of 0.1 degrees Celsius per decade over the next 20 years. This is mainly due to the slow response of the ocean. Interestingly, the choice of emission scenario has little effect on the temperature rise to 2030, making this a very robust estimate. All models thus suggest twice the rate of temperature increase in the next two decades compared with the 20th century. What is significant is that the choices we make now in terms of global emissions will have a significant effect on global warming after 2030. Again, using the 23 different carbon dioxide emission scenarios, the IPCC has projected global mean sea level up to 2100. The AOGCMs predict an increase in global mean sea level of between 18 centimeters and 59 centimeters. These estimates are lower than those in the IPCC 2001 report, the reason being because they have taken out the possible contribution of ice flow. Although ice flow rates increased between 1992 and 2003 in both Greenland and Antarctica, it is unknown whether this contribution will continue. If the contribution is linear with surface warming, then another 10 centimeters to 20 centimeters can be added to the sea level estimates, giving a range of 28 centimeters to 79 centimeters by 2100. One of the biggest unknowns in global warming is what will happen to Greenland and Antarctica in the next 100 years, as there is a lot of evidence that they are starting to melt. See Chapter 6. There is also scientific debate about what may happen to both the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets beyond the next 100 years. Some scientists believe what happens in the next 100 years will determine the future of these ice sheets. One prediction suggests that though the Greenland ice sheet will not collapse in the next 100 years, global warming will start a process that will be irreversible, and Greenland will be free of ice within the next 1,000 years. What the skeptics say. One of the best ways to summarize the problems of modeling the global warming future is to review what the skeptics say, as they have many valid points and provide a basis from which our models should be improved. 1. Clouds can have both a positive and negative feedback on global climate. How do we know they will not reduce the effects of global warming so that it occurs to a negligible degree? As has been the case since the very first IPCC report in 1990, the greatest uncertainty in future predictions is the role of the clouds and their interaction with radiation. Clouds can both absorb and reflect radiation, thereby cooling the surface, and absorb and emit long-wave radiation, thus warming the surface. The competition between these effects depends on a number of factors: height, thickness, and radiative properties of clouds. The radiative properties and formation and development of clouds depend on the distribution of atmospheric water vapor, water drops, ice particles, atmospheric aerosols, and cloud thickness. The physical basis of how clouds are represented or parametrized in the AOGCMs has greatly improved through the inclusion of bulk representations of cloud microphysical properties in the cloud water budget equations. However, clouds still represent a significant source of potential error in climate simulations. It is still controversial whether clouds help warm or cool the planet, and both situations are found in the various AOGCMs. However, it is interesting that even in those AOGCMs in which clouds cause a cooling effect, this effect is not strong enough to counter the other warming trends. 2. Different models give different results, so how can we trust any of them? This is a frequent response from many people not familiar with modeling, as there is a feeling that somehow science must be able to predict an exact future. However, in no other walk of life do we expect this precision. For example, you would never expect to get a perfect prediction of which horse will win a race or which football team will emerge triumphant. The truth is that none of the climate models is exactly right. But what they provide is the best estimate that we have of the future. Now, this view of the future is strengthened by the use of more than one model, because each model has been developed by different groups of scientists around the world, using different assumptions and different computers, and thus they provide their own particular future prediction. What causes scientists to have confidence in the model results is that they all roughly predict the same trend in global temperature and sea level for the next 100 years. One of the great strengths of the 2007 IPCC report is that it used 23 international models, compared to 7 in 2001, to produce future predictions. Another strength of this large-scale multiple model approach is that scientists can also give an estimation of how confident they are in the model results and also a range of possible predictions. The day that scientists give an exact estimate of what is going to happen and when is the day they will lose all credibility, rather like being told to invest in the U.S. stock market just before the 1929 crash, as stock markets can never go down, or being sold a mortgage in the early 1980s in the UK and being told that there is no way the housing market will crash. 3. Climate models fail to predict abrupt weather conditions. AOGCMs are not able to predict abrupt weather events because their spatial resolution is too coarse. For example, the whole of the British Isles is represented by 10 points. This has led to the accusation by the skeptics that the random or chaotic factors which influence our day-to-day weather must also influence our climate. It has been known since the late 1960s that weather patterns are chaotic, as the Earth's climate system is sensitive to extremely small perturbations in initial conditions. For example, Extremely slight changes in air pressure over the USA have an influence on the direction and duration of a hurricane. We all know that this sensitivity limits the prediction accuracy of detailed weather forecasts to about 2 weeks. Sometimes it feels like 2 days. However, predictability of climate is not limited in the same way as the prediction of the weather, because the longer-term systematic influences on the atmosphere are not reliant on the initial conditions. So the longer-term trends in regional and global climate are not controlled by small-scale influences. However, what the global warming skeptics are correct about is that at present, we cannot model abrupt climate changes that may occur in the future. These potential surprises are discussed in Chapter 6. 4. Climate models fail to reconstruct or predict natural variability. The global climate system contains cyclic variations which occur on a decade or sub-decade timescale. The most famous is El Niño, which is a change in both ocean and atmospheric circulation in the Pacific region, occurring every 3 to 7 years, that has a major influence on the rest of the global climate. Skeptics argue that climate models have been unable to simulate satisfactorily these events in the past. However, climate models have become better at reconstructing these past variations in El Niño Southern Oscillation, ENSO, North Atlantic Oscillation, NAO, and related Arctic Oscillation, AO, as there has been an increasing realization that these have a profound impact upon regional climate. Most models are able to depict these natural variations, picking out particularly the 1976 climate shift, which occurred in the Pacific Ocean. All the AOGCMs have predicted outcomes for ENSO and NAO for the next 100 years. However, a lot of improvement is required before there will be confidence in the model predictions. It is, though, testament to the realism of the AOGCMs that they can indeed reconstruct and predict future trends in these short-term oscillations. 5. The thermohaline circulation is not properly characterized in the climate models. The deep, or thermohaline circulation, THC, of the world's oceans is one of the basic building blocks of the coupled atmosphere-ocean GCMs. Hence, the simulations of the thermohaline circulation for the present day and the past are very good. However, uncertainties concerning the modeling of the future of the THC come from the complexities controlling deep water formation, including the interplay in the large-scale atmospheric forcing between the warming and evaporation in the low latitudes and cooling and increased precipitation at high latitudes. In addition, ENSO can play a part by altering the freshwater balance of the tropical Atlantic. Add to this the uncertainties in the representation both of the small-scale flows over sills and through narrow straits and of ocean convection, which further limit the ability of the models to simulate situations involving substantial change in the THC. Hence, most future predictions from AOGCMs have a similar or slightly reduced THC to the present. One way modelers get round the problem of having a slightly simplified representation of the ocean circulation in the AOGCMs is to run very high-resolution ocean models offline. So you can run hundreds of different forcings on the oceans over hundreds of simulated years very quickly, and this is where our understanding of the sensitivity of the ocean comes from. 6. AOGCMs fail to reconstruct past climate, particularly the last ice age. Past climates are an important test for global climate models. The biggest climate shift, for which we have many paleoclimate reconstructions, is that of the last ice age, which ended about 10,000 years ago. A comparison between paleoclimate data for the most extreme stage of the ice age, which occurred 18,000 years ago, suggests that the global climate models are rather good. It shows that the AOGCMs used for predicting future climate can do a good job of reconstructing the extreme conditions of an ice age. Sea level, 120 meters lower, 6 degrees Celsius drop in global temperatures, atmospheric carbon dioxide one-third lower, and atmospheric methane halved. One important observation is that the models are conservative, and they systematically underestimated the climate changes. This means we can assume that the future climate predictions are also conservative, and thus climate change is very likely to be at the top end of the estimates. 7. Galactic cosmic rays, GCRs, are ignored in the current climate models, which invalidates the models. Galactic cosmic rays are high-energy particles that cause ionization in the atmosphere and may, therefore, affect cloud formation. GCRs vary inversely with solar variability because of the effect of solar wind. This is an excellent example of how climate science progresses by discovering new knowledge and, if it is important enough, adding it into the climate models. Very little is known about this newly discovered external forcing, GCRs, so research is continuing into this phenomenon to see if it has a sufficiently large effect to be included in the climate models. Unfortunately, it affects one of the least well-understood processes in our climate system, that of cloud formation. But the discovery that GCRs may influence climate does not invalidate the climate models because it is all part of the progressive nature of science. We do not know everything about the climate system, and we never will. Our understanding will continually improve as science progresses. Hence, model predictions of the future are continually improving. It should, however, be remembered that these models are based on the present understanding of the climate system and will inevitably change in the future. Summary. Using a wide range of possible carbon emissions over the next 100 years, the climate models suggest the global mean surface temperature could rise by between 1.1 degrees Celsius and 6.4 degrees Celsius by 2100. Using the best estimates for the six emission scenarios, then, this range is 1.8 degrees Celsius to 4 degrees Celsius by 2100. However, we must remember that global carbon dioxide emissions are already rising faster than the most dire of the IPCC emission scenarios. The models also predict an increase in global mean sea level of between 18 centimeters and 59 centimeters. If the contribution from the melting of Greenland and Antarctica is included, then this increases the range to between 28 centimeters and 79 centimeters by 2100. This is assuming a continued linear response between global temperatures and ice sheets, which is unlikely. And thus, sea level rise could be much higher. However, some leading climate scientists have voiced their concern that the IPCC 2007 predictions are too conservative. For example, Professor Jim Hansen of Columbia University suggests that if we reach 450 ppm carbon dioxide, then we may have passed the tipping point for the irreversible melting of Greenland and the West Antarctic ice sheet. If this happens, then we may see even larger rises in sea level in this century. Hence, Hansen suggests that if we are to save the ice sheets, we need to return to a global level of 350 ppm as quickly as possible. Chapter 5. What are the possible future impacts? As discussed in previous chapters, there is strong evidence to suggest that humanity's greenhouse gas emissions have already started to influence our climate. The most sophisticated and powerful computer models suggest global warming will cause major climatic changes by the end of the 21st century. These changes will potentially have wide-ranging effects on the natural environment as well as on human societies and our economies. Estimates have been made concerning the potential direct impacts on various socioeconomic sectors, but in reality, the full consequences are complicated to predict because impacts on one sector have an indirect effect on others. We are only just realizing how climate change policies can have negative effects on society. For example, as discussed later in this chapter, the recent rush to produce biofuels to mitigate global warming may have contributed to food price rises because of competition for land. To assess these potential impacts, it is necessary to estimate the extent and magnitude of climate change, especially at national and local levels. For example, the IPCC 2007 reports look at the impacts on a continental level. There are also a number of excellent national reports and tools, such as the U.S. National Assessment Synthesis Team, 2001, and the U.K. Climate Impacts Program, UKCIP, 2008. The UKCIP website, with its interactive tools, is a model for other countries, as it allows anyone to assess the impacts of climate change in the UK. This is becoming an essential tool for policymakers and businesses alike in the UK. What is dangerous climate change? One of the most important questions for scientists and policymakers is, what is dangerous climate change? Of course, this does depend on where you live. For example, if you are one of the small island nations, any sea level rise could be considered dangerous because it directly results in loss of land. However, on the bigger picture, if we are to cut global greenhouse emissions, we need a realistic target concerning the degree of global temperature increase with which we can cope. In February 2005, the British government convened an international science meeting at Exeter, UK, to discuss this very topic. This was a very political science meeting, as the UK government was looking for a recommendation to take to the G8 meeting in Gleneagles. In 2005, Britain was both the chair of the G8 and president of the EU, and the then Prime Minister Tony Blair wished to push forward internationally his joint agenda of climate change and poverty alleviation in Africa. The meeting did come up with a magic number of 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial average temperature. Below this threshold, there seemed to be both winners and losers due to regional climate change, but above this figure, everyone seems to lose. It isn't just this particular meeting that has come up with the magic 2 degrees Celsius limit. Many other researchers, including at the IPCC, have arrived at similar conclusions from very different backgrounds and starting assumptions. Again, 2 degrees Celsius seems to be at the point where the numbers increase radically. So 2 degrees Celsius has become a powerful and important symbol of the challenges facing human society. The major problem is that it is unlikely we can keep global temperature increases down to 2 degrees Celsius, as we have already seen temperature increase by 0.76 degrees Celsius. And even if we kept atmospheric carbon dioxide levels at the 2000 levels, that would still add at least another 0.6 degrees Celsius. So without doing anything, we are already up to nearly 1.4 degrees Celsius. Next, we look at the general effects of global warming to give you an idea of what the future may hold. Extreme events and society's coping range. The single biggest problem with global warming is our inability to predict the future. Humanity can live, survive, and even flourish in extreme climates from the Arctic to the Sahara, but problems arise when the predictable extremes of local climate are exceeded. For example, heat waves, storms, droughts, and floods in one region may be considered fairly normal weather in another. This is because each society has a coping range, a range of weather with which it can deal. In our present climate, the coping range encompasses nearly all the variation in weather, with maybe only one or two extreme events. As the climate moves gently to its new average, if the coping range stays the same, then many more extreme events occur. For example, in the historically mild climate of Britain, homes are built with central heating, but not air conditioning. As summer temperatures increase and heat waves like 2003 become common, then the coping range of our homes will be exceeded, and we will need air conditioning. One of the biggest challenges of global warming is to start to build as much flexibility and resilience into society's coping ranges as possible. To do this, we must take the latest predictions of the IPCC and apply these across the globe to help protect people and their environments. As we have seen, the IPCC 2007 report estimates that global mean surface temperature could rise by between 1.1 and 6.4 degrees Celsius by 2100. There will be significant regional changes in precipitation, and global mean sea level could rise by between at least 18 centimeters and 59 centimeters by 2100. Future climate change will have impacts on all factors affecting human society, including coastal regions, storms and floods, heat waves and droughts, health, water resources, agriculture, and biodiversity. Next, each of these key areas of concern and the possible impacts of climate change will be reviewed. What cannot be assessed are the impacts if climate change occurs more abruptly, and this possibility is discussed in Chapter 6. Coastline. As we have seen, the IPCC reports that sea level could rise by between 18 centimeters and 59 centimeters in the next 100 years, primarily through the thermal expansion of the oceans. If we include a simplistic assumption about Greenland and Antarctica, this could rise to 28 centimeters to 79 centimeters by 2100. This prediction is of major concern to all coastal areas, as rising sea levels will reduce the effectiveness of coastal defenses against storms and floods, and increase the instability of cliffs and beaches. In Britain, the USA, and the rest of the developed world, the response to this danger has been to add another few feet to the height of seawalls around property on the coast, the abandoning of some poorer quality agricultural land to the sea, as it is no longer worth the expense of protecting it, and the enhancement of legal protection for coastal wetlands, being nature's best defense against the sea. However, globally, there are some nations based on small islands and river deltas that face a much more urgent situation. For small island nations, such as the Maldives in the Indian Ocean and the Marshall Islands in the Pacific, a 1 meter rise in sea level would flood up to 75% of the dry land, making the islands uninhabitable. Interestingly, it is also these countries which rely on tourism that have some of the highest fossil fuel emissions per head of population. However, there is a different twist to the story if we consider nations where a significant portion of the population live by river deltas. These include, for example, Bangladesh, Egypt, Nigeria, and Thailand. A World Bank report in 1994 concluded that human activities on the deltas, such as freshwater extraction, were causing these areas to sink much faster than any predicted rise in sea level, increasing their vulnerability to storms and floods. In the case of Bangladesh, over three-quarters of the country is within the deltaic region formed by the confluence of the Ganges, Brahmaputra, and Meghna rivers. Over half the country lies less than 5 meters above sea level. Thus, flooding is a common occurrence. During the summer monsoon, a quarter of the country is flooded. Yet, these floods, like those of the Nile, bring with them life as well as destruction. The water irrigates and the silt fertilizes the land. The fertile Bengal Delta supports one of the world's most dense populations, over 110 million people in 140,000 square kilometers. But the monsoon floods have been getting worse throughout the 1990s. Every year, the Bengal Delta should receive over 1 billion tons of sediment and 1,000 cubic kilometers of fresh water. This sediment load balances the erosion of the delta both by natural processes and human activity. However, the Ganges River has been diverted in India into the Hooghly Channel for irrigation. The reduced sediment input is causing the delta to subside. Exacerbating this is the rapid extraction of fresh water. In the 1980s, 100,000 tube wells and 20,000 deep wells were sunk, increasing the freshwater extraction sixfold. Both these projects are essential to improving the quality of life for people in this region, but have produced a subsidence rate of up to 2.5 centimeters per year, one of the highest rates in the world. Using estimates of subsidence rate and global warming sea level rise, the World Bank has estimated that by the end of the 21st century, the relative sea level in Bangladesh could rise by as much as 1.8 meters. In a worst-case scenario, they estimated that this would result in a loss of up to 16% of land, supporting 13% of the population, and producing 12% of the current gross domestic product, GDP. Unfortunately, this scenario does not take any account of the devastation of the mangrove forest and the associated fisheries. Moreover, increased landward intrusions of saltwater would further damage water quality and agriculture. Another example of a threatened coastline is the Nile Delta, which is one of the oldest intensely cultivated areas on Earth. It is very heavily populated, with population densities up to 1,600 inhabitants per square kilometer. Deserts surround the low-lying fertile floodplains. Only 2.5% of Egypt's land area, the Nile Delta and the Nile Valley, are suitable for intensive agriculture. Most of a 50-kilometer-wide land strip along the coast is less than 2 meters above sea level, and is only protected from flooding by a 1 to 10 kilometer-wide coastal sand belt, shaped by discharge of the Rosetta and Damietta branches of the Nile. Erosion of the protective sand belt is a serious problem and has accelerated since the construction of the Aswan Dam in the south of Egypt. A rising sea level would destroy weak parts of the sand belt, which are essential for the protection of lagoons and the low-lying reclaimed lands. These impacts could be very damaging. About one-third of Egypt's fish catches are made in the lagoons, and sea level rise would change the water quality and affect most freshwater fish. Valuable agricultural land would be inundated. Vital low-lying installations in Alexandria and Port Said would be threatened. Recreational tourism beach facilities would be endangered, and essential groundwater would be salinated. Many of these effects are preventable, as dikes and protective measures would stop the worst flooding up to a 50-centimeter sea level rise, though there may still be considerable groundwater salination, and the impact of increasing wave action could be serious. The most important influence on the impact of sea level rise on coastal regions is the rate of change. At the moment, the predicted rise of about 50 centimeters in the next 100 years can be dealt with if there is the economic foresight to plan for the protection and adaptation of coastal regions. This then comes back to the development of regional economies and the availability of resources to implement appropriate changes. If sea level rises by over 1 meter in the next 100 years, which is thought to be unlikely according to the IPCC, then humanity would doubtless have major problems adapting to it. Storms and floods. Storms and floods are major natural hazards, and between 1951 and 1999, were responsible for 76% of the global insured losses, 58% of the economic losses, and 52% of fatalities from natural catastrophes. It is, therefore, essential we know what is likely to happen in the future. There is some evidence that the temperate regions, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, have become more stormy over the last 50 years. The model simulations for the next 100 years for storms in mid-latitude regions differ widely. The computer models do, however, suggest that the proportion of rainfall occurring as heavy rainfall has and will continue to increase, as will the year-to-year variability. This will increase the frequency of flooding events. 2/5 of the world's population lives under the monsoon belt, which brings life-giving rains. Monsoons are driven by the temperature contrast between continents and oceans. For example, moisture-laden surface air blows from the Indian Ocean to the Asian continent and from the Atlantic Ocean into West Africa during Northern Hemisphere summers, when the land masses become much warmer than the adjacent ocean. In winter, the continents become colder than the adjacent oceans, and high pressure develops at the surface, causing surface winds to blow towards the ocean. Climate models indicate an increase in the strength of the summer monsoons as a result of global warming over the next 100 years. There are three reasons to support why this should occur. 1. Global warming will cause continents to warm more than the ocean in summer, and this is the primary driving force of the monsoon system. 2. Decreased snow cover on Tibet, expected in a warmer world, will increase this temperature difference between land and sea, increasing the strength of the Asian summer. 3. Warmer climate means the air can hold more water vapor, so the monsoon winds will be able to carry more moisture. For the Asian summer monsoon, this could mean an increase of 10 to 20% in average rainfall, with an interannual variability of 25 to 100%. And a dramatic increase in the number of days with heavy rain. The most worrying model finding is the predicted increase in rain variability between years, which could double, making it very difficult to predict how much rainfall will occur each year. Essential knowledge for farmers. An exception to this increase is given by the Met Office Hadley Center, GCM, which predicts reduced rainfall over Amazonia, but increased rainfall in the other monsoon systems. This case study is discussed in more detail in the next chapter. As we have seen in Chapter 3, there seems to be growing evidence that numbers of hurricanes and their intensity have increased over the last three decades in the North Atlantic and Western Pacific Oceans. Kerry Emanuel, MIT, and Peter Webster, Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta, and colleagues, using different methods, have demonstrated that the number and intensity of hurricanes are directly linked to the sea surface temperature. So as global warming increases ocean temperatures, then it will become possible for more hurricanes to be spawned. But the effects of hurricanes on human society are not only related to their numbers or intensity, but rather whether they will make landfall, and if they do, where. For example, 1992 was a very quiet year for hurricanes in the North Atlantic Ocean. However, in August, one of the few hurricanes that year, Hurricane Andrew, hit the USA just north of Miami and caused damage estimated at $20 billion. In terms of where hurricanes hit in developed countries, the major effect is usually economic loss, while in developing countries, the main effect is loss of life. For example, Hurricane Katrina, which hit New Orleans in 2005, caused 1,500 deaths. Hurricane Mitch, which hit Central America, killed at least 25,000 people. Hurricane Katrina was not the worst storm that has hit the USA. A storm that hit Miami in 1926 was 150% larger, but did little damage because Miami Beach was yet to be developed. In the USA, coastal population has doubled in the last 10 to 15 years. So in terms of climate change, therefore, mitigation policies will have little effect on the costs in the developed world, while adaptation of coastal regions will be essential. But in the developing world, mitigation would have a large impact in reducing the total loss of life and preventing regional economic meltdown. For example, the immediate economic impact of Hurricane Katrina was over $150 billion. But its subsequent effect on the U.S. economy was to boost it slightly, by 1% that year, due to the $105 billion injected by the Bush administration to help the reconstruction of the region. Compare this with Hurricane Mitch, which set back the economy of Central America by about a decade. As can be seen from the case of Hurricane Katrina, storms and floods have the ability to destroy major cities. Many major cities around the world are vulnerable to flooding because they were built close to rivers or the coast to facilitate trade via the oceans. London is one such city. At the moment, London is protected from flooding by the Thames Barrier. The Thames Barrier was built in response to the catastrophic floods in 1953 and was finally ready for use in 1982. It was officially opened on 8 May 1984. The Thames Barrier protects 150 square kilometers of London and property worth at least £80 billion. Because of the foresight of previous scientific advisors to the UK government, it was built to withstand a 1 in 2,000 year flood. With the increased sea level due to global warming, this risk by 2030 will increase to a 1 in 1,000 year event. For example, between 1982 and 2001, it was closed 63 times. In the winter 2000-2001, it was closed 24 times. In 2003, the barrier was closed for 14 consecutive tides, and in November 2007, it was closed twice for a storm surge the same size as the one that occurred in 1953. At the moment, the UK economy is the fifth largest in the world, approximately £1.4 trillion per year generated through London. London is also one of the three main centers, along with New York and Tokyo, for 24-hour share trading. If London were disabled by a major flood, then not only would this hit the economy of the UK, it potentially could disrupt global trade and precipitate a global recession. Hence, the UK Environment Agency has plans for significant sea level rise into the future, including a prospective plan for a 4.5-meter rise. Heat waves and drought.